Do you line up with Republicans or Democrats and think that the machinery that is those parties operates pretty much with or without you? People keep voting and nothing seems to get any better. Maybe the people aren't the problem. Maybe the system is the problem. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 237. Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello, folks. Welcome back to the podcast. Mike Gatti, who has been on this show, hosts his own radio show, the Rebel Madman Radio Show. This is the first hour of two of our interview. Some of the introduction portions about me, longtime listeners of this show will already know. Mike asked me on to discuss my move from statist Republican to libertarian. I've taken the commercial breaks out, but in a few places you'll hear the ascending music.
Today we're going to take a little bit different approach. But it should be very, very interesting. I have a really special guest with me today. I would like to introduce the folks to my guest, none other than the culinary libertarian himself, Dan Reed. Dan, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. How are you, Mike?
Well, if I was any better, I would be illegal in at least four states. So that being said, I'm sure folks are intrigued by the name, the Culinary Libertarian. Now, I have been fortunate to be your guest on at least two occasions on your podcast. So why don't you take a couple of minutes and tell the folks about Dan Reed?
Well, it's probably 90 seconds more than I need.
Okay.
Well, the culinary part, I spent a great deal of my younger self life cooking in kitchen, professional kitchens, working my way up to the title of chef. And since that wasn't enough, I moved into pastry and baking. So I can do hot side cooking, baking, and pastry stuff, and that seemed to be enough. The libertarian part's kind of interesting, partly because there's a lot of things that a lot of us don't know, and we come to find them as we move, if we're willing to find them, as we move through our journey. And I don't know how much time we've got for this part, but I started, like probably nearly everybody, on one side or the other of the R and D paradigm. I grew up in the early 80s, and my stepfather was a realtor in the Carter/Reagan transition from 70s to 80s. And at least in Northern Michigan, selling a house at that time was a very difficult thing to do. But he was a Republican. He was Reagan. And so when you're in high school, I think it's fairly common, you just sort of adopt the views of the parents in the house. That seems perfectly normal. Well, that was fine. And then I went to work in kitchens, and politics really didn't matter. There was a line cook because you have prep to get done, young man. So get busy and get your head out of the world and focus in the kitchen. And that was fine for a while. And then things changed. I started getting interested in economics because it seemed like everything that happened politically had some economic angle to it. We want to give you things for free, except it's not for free. We want to have a foreign policy that's going to cost you money. But so I started trying to learn more about economics, and I found this little short fellow named Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman and economics in a way that I had never even heard about it. Usually it's this piles of numbers that just are designed maybe to intimidate and exclude people from understanding anything. So I went down that rabbit hole, which led to some mainstream libertarian thinkers, and then that's kind of where the story really begins. That's when I met you, when I was calling myself a libertarian, the culinary libertarian. How it applied to the blog and the show was there's a lot of politics in food that maybe people don't really understand. You know, like the Wholesome Meat Act of 1967 created the virtual monopoly there is with four major meat packers and producers. So there's a reason you can't get cows butchered 5 miles up the road. The reason you can't get that is because, you know, without the government, who would starve us? So there, it was a way to put politics and food together, and I guess part of the talk we'll have is what happened after that.
Well, here's the thing, Dan, and I believe that there are just literally millions of people out there who are sitting in this path right now, who may be asking themselves, they may have aligned themselves with the D's or the R's, and they may have said, well, you know, something just isn't right here. And usually that first step is from taken from the R or the Republican, and then that transition is made to the L, Libertarian, whether it's big L or small L. Would you be so kind as to tell the people, and like I said, we're probably talking to people who are in that transition at some point or another. At least let's hope we're talking to those people. So would you elaborate a little bit on what took you from R to L?
Yeah, as well as I can, I'm happy to do that. It's a funny thing because I've been asked that question a few times, and while I desperately wish there was a specific singular aha moment, there really isn't. But maybe that's really the thing. Maybe it isn't one thing happening that says, oh my gosh, now I understand. It's probably the one thing not happening. They keep having these elections, people keep showing up, people keep voting, and nothing really ever happens. So what, and that may be really the first thing is, like, you know, we've had all these different people in. We keep being told we have to elect the right people, and presumably the right people, the ones who are running, because why would you vote for the wrong people? But nothing ever changed. And I think it's a tough, I wish I had a specific response to this is the thing that happened or didn't happen and made me investigate this. I went through the standard right-wing radio folks. I went through Rush and gave up on Rush. I did Hannity, gave up on Hannity. Went through Levin, gave up on Levin. Did Glenn Beck for a while. And Glenn was refreshing because he wasn't saying the same things as the other mainstream Republican thinkers. And I don't know exactly what it was about Glenn that made me leave. But in retrospect, I can say that those main talk show hosts kept people in a box. It was just a different box. And all you have to do, you have to go and you have to vote harder. You have to vote for the right guys. If you didn't get the right guys, well, you have to vilify the other guy. And for 240-ish years, nothing has really changed. Government hasn't gotten smaller. Your freedoms haven't increased. Your liberties haven't increased. It's like, if you're willing to, and maybe that's the key, if you're willing to really examine what is happening to you because of government, what is being taken away from you because of government, an honest introspection and examination leads to a fairly unsettling conclusion that all of these years I've been told to participate in something that isn't benefiting me in the least. And so, yeah, it benefits me because why? I have a road. Oh, well, thank you so much. It's as if some guy building the store selling shoes couldn't figure out how to get traffic to a store selling shoes. That's not really a difficult challenge. So it isn't fast. By no means is it quick. It's an incremental thing to question first what's going on. Why are these people telling me these things? Why are they lying to me? And it's not really that you come to that conclusion right away. you want to give them, the speakers, the benefit of the doubt. And that's any speakers. That's even us, by the way, folks. Just because I'm saying something different than someone else says, you have a, this is the hard part. You have a responsibility to yourself to do your own research. Now, that's hard. How do I do that? Do your own research. Do your own investigation. Find out what have you been told. How does that jive with what's going on? And then you get to a point where you can look at what's happening in the world. Forget the world. What's happening in your town, in your community, in your state, in your nation. I hate the word nation. In your country. And something doesn't fit. It's square pegs and round holes, but you've been told that that's the right order. The square peg is supposed to go in the round hole, and if you question that, well, then you're all manner of things that are unfit for society, and we're going to cancel you. And if you think that that's wrong, take a look around.
Well, Dan, I have usually found in talking with folks, and I was part of this as well during my transition, but usually the more folks I talk to and I talk about the transition from the R to the L, almost invariably the name Ron Paul comes up. Is that true in your case as well?
Ron came up eventually. The first mainstream libertarian person that I found and gravitated to was Tom Woods. And Tom had, I think at the time, some 800 or 900 podcast episodes out. And the first thing that was refreshing about a libertarian point of view was that it didn't, that it was outside of the traditional R&D mainstream point of view. And it dared question the narrative, of R&D. So, Tom has lots and lots of catchphrases, but one of the, and some of them are at least valid points in the observation that the R and the D are both going to want to tax you. The difference is going to be one wants to tax you at 1%, one wants to tax you at 2%. And somehow the being taxed at a lower rate is better than not being taxed at all. Somehow that the not being taxed part is never part of the discussion. It's always, you will be taxed. We will steal from you. But who do you want to steal less from you? Oh, well, then that's my guy. Never mind all of the horrible consequences that come after thinking that guy is going to steal less from you. So Woods led to Ron Paul. And I remember, so this is one of those in the kitchen things. I remember there was a world going on when I was cooking. I had an across the street neighbor who had a magnetic sign on his car for Ron Paul. I think it was the 08 campaign. And this fellow was not a particularly good advocate for his candidate because I said, who's Ron Paul? And his response was, some crazy old guy. Well, all right, that doesn't compel me want to go learn more about Ron Paul. So I didn't go learn more. Because if the guy's shilling for him, can't say anything good about him, well, I have other things to do. So it took a while. I did not have the Giuliani moment that many people talk about in their transition, and maybe the most famous or easy to spot person would be Dave Smith, who's a libertarian comedian and has his own podcast. And but lots of people, I think Scott Horton and Spike Lee have talked about, not Spike Lee, Spike Cohen have talked about their the Giuliani moment as really being transitional in making them see, wow, there is another way to view this. And I'm not going to do it justice, and it's certainly some it might be off of YouTube for now. Who knows? But basically, during the campaign debates, Giuliani said the mainstream party line that they attacked us for our freedoms, and Ron Paul had the temerity to say that's not at all close to right. They attacked us because we've been bombing them to smithereens for years, and they're mad about it. It's blowback from all the way back to the Shah of Iran. Well, the whole idea of blowback, the whole idea of the U.S. being responsible for something that happened to them 50 or 60 years later, that's obscene. That's absurd. How can you say such a thing? Because no, I don't think Americans, I don't think we think in terms of that much time. But if it's something that their action and reaction, I think we think that it has to be almost immediate, like in a boxing match. You punch me, you get punched. And that was new to me. The whole idea that you could do something in one decade and 5 decades later pay the price for that, that's a game changer of a concept. And if you understand that other countries are willing to wait out that time. Now, this probably gets really complicated foreign policy right away. So it's not the people of the country. The American people didn't do that. The people in Iraq and Libya and Syria and all the other places in the world aren't the ones who are doing the things. It's the governments of the world. But some of those governments have really long memories, and they're very, very patient. And
well, Dan,
they felt, yes.
Well, you bring up something there which I remember very distinctly. A gentleman that I got to know very well, a Colonel Musabne, U.S. citizen, but first generation U.S. citizen, Lebanese. And we were having a conversation at one time, and he brought about an analogy of what you just said. And he told me, he said, traditional Americans have a problem in that they believe that their culture is just like everybody else's. He said, but let me tell you, and he gave me an example, which was kind of a, you know, I don't know what we would call it, but he said, look, there were two Arabs who were talking to each other. Now, Colonel Musabne was a Muslim. But I had all of the greatest respect for him as a person, as an individual. But he made the statement to me. He said, well, there were two Arabs talking. And one of them told the other one, said, well, you know what? I finally killed the guy who raped my daughter 30 years ago. I finally killed him. The other Arab looks at him and says, what was your rush? So that gave me an insight into a mindset. And I think we as Americans do make that assumption that everybody thinks like we do. And I think the illustration that you just gave is a perfect example of that. So, yes, they have a long memory. And that memory is passed on to their posterity. And therefore, you know, what you were saying there was most relevant to that. I'm sorry, Dan, that I interrupted you with that little anecdote, but I found it fitting at the moment. But again, Americans do not respect other cultures. That's one of the things I have found in my lifetime, because we have this American superiority thing that if, okay, whatever your culture is, if it doesn't agree with mine, you're wrong. And I believe that has led us into all kind of misunderstandings and wars with people that we really don't understand. So pardon my interruption, Dan, but please continue.
No, it was a good point. I wouldn't have been able to tell that story because I don't know anybody who told me that. But one of the things that I mentioned discovering is the wrong word, learning about was economics. The other thing that really made a big impact in my thinking outside of R&D was foreign affairs. And I did end up listening to a lot of Ron Paul stuff because it seems to me that foreign affairs, now I'm going to kind of get out of my depth here because I'm not really able to speak on international stuff particularly well, but foreign affairs drives domestic affairs. And it took me a little while to figure that out, and I'm going to struggle to sort of explain why I think that that's the case. But so I guess we can use Ukraine as an example, at least on a couple of levels. I think I read, maybe I'm going to get the number wrong, somewhere in the upwards of $500 billion has been sent to Ukraine from the U.S., which is your money and my money, for who knows why. On a domestic policy, what could your local government do? Now, even forgetting all the part about the taxation is wrong and the government is in the business of paying states, if they did that, what could $500 billion sent to 50 different states, funneled down through the communities, how could that have helped domestically Americans? Are there some issues that Americans have that resources would help at least solve part of that problem? I'm betting the answer is yes to that. So we're paying for something that we don't actually get any, we're not getting any value for it. Whether or not you think that war was just or unjust isn't really part of the story, I don't think. The fact that we had no say in where an obscene amount of cash went is a big problem. And those, so when we go back to, and I don't know anything about the Shah in the 60s, but intervening in the affairs of other countries to the point that it irritates and angers particular political factions to have a long memory of a wrongdoing. That's not the business. I don't think it's the business of any government, but it's certainly not the business of the government that claims to be representing me. I want no part of that. Yet that doesn't seem to matter to the government that doesn't care. So that's not a particularly adequate explanation or illustration of how foreign affairs dictates domestic affairs. But in one way, the spending, the giving away, the gifting of cash to people who aren't going to give it back, and that's taking away from the American people. First of all, you took the cash in the first place, although the economics of it all is you haven't paid for that yet. Wait for next tax season, and then you'll pay it back. But it's doing harm to Americans who are going to be paying higher taxes. It's doing harm to Americans who aren't getting products or services from the government if that's what they're in the business of doing. And that's a domestic policy problem, which could be alleviated if we were not in the foreign affairs business.
Well, Dan, here's a question for you, and I've asked this question because it is my posit that wars are the greatest money laundering campaign known to man. And what proof do we have that any of this money actually went to the Ukraine?
As far as I know, there's no proof of that, although allegedly – Zelensky has some really swag mansions that would make Bernie Sanders blush. I'm going to ask or pose an even more incendiary idea that how do we know for a fact there's actually war going on?
That is true and a very valid comment. But let's go back to just jump back one war. Let's go back to the war in Iraq in 2004. When America allegedly sent billions of dollars in $100 bills on various C-130s, something in the neighborhood of $12 billion that we sent to Iraq. And once it got to Iraq, and Paul Bremer, a former UNICAL executive, was in charge in Iraq at the time, and allegedly that $12 billion disappeared. So, and then, of course, they did a very quick cover-up and said, oh, we found it. But where is the evidence it was ever found? And we can go back to a war of my era of Vietnam, and there was a great book that was written by John Paul Vann, and there was a lot of questions in there that near the end of the war, 72, 73, that we sent millions of dollars to Vietnam to pay off the people who had assisted us there, like the Hmong, the Chinese. And but what evidence do we have that that money, the money, the billions of dollars on the C-130s and this money to the Ukraine, how do we know that this did not go into the hands of the international banking cabal?
I have no answer to that. I have no way of knowing whether they did or did not.
Well, is there any of the 330 plus million Americans who could tell us for sure where that money went? In your estimation?
There may be one or two, and if they dared say they are going to opine what happened to that, I think they would they would slip and fall on a patch of ice in the middle of August.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's been known to happen, you know. Some people, if you have ever contradicted the government on anything, do not get on an airplane.
Or drive a car
or, you know, go to a parade in Dallas, Texas. You just don't want to do those things. But kind of jumping back now to your transition, and I think that's really critical because I think we have, as I said before, not to be redundant, but we have millions of people in this country who I think are sitting around going, something ain't right. Dan, a thought went through my mind while we were on break there because I was thinking back to my own experiences and I was wondering about yours. During this transition period, when you went from R to L, was there a time where you felt like, hey, am I the only person who sees this? Did that ever cross your mind?
No, I think I thought that was late to the party. It would seem that lots of people had figured this out, and I was the one that showed up late.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense, too, because I also felt something like that because I was of course, my wife can remind you of this because during the time that I was in Southeast Asia, she was at Kent State University when the atrocity took place there. And odd that we would meet those years later. And I used to give her a hard time all the time. Very early on in our relationship, I would hold up my hand and go, oh, Kent State 0, U.S. Government 3. And, of course, she's never let me forget that. But that was my position back then. I was, yes, okay. That old adage, and I remember this being said over and over again, my country, right or wrong, it's still my country. Well, you know, and I think too many of us bought into that concept. And we believed it because when your country is wrong, it's wrong. Morally, ethically, it's wrong. And to support it, which so many continue to do today, is the very reason that the corruption and the killing and everything else continues is because the people still feel like my country, right or wrong, this is still my country. Well, your country and your government are two different entities. And at what point in your transformation, Dan, did you come to the realization that your country and your government are two different entities?
I think that's been a fairly recent. What does that mean? I'm going to say probably in the last couple of years was I able to really distinguish between those two things. And this is kind of, I was commenting to somebody the other day that, you know, everybody, there isn't a person, I don't think, on the planet Earth who hasn't been impacted or been told about the COVID hysteria. And now I think there's a lot of people who personally know people who have died from COVID. I don't know anybody. Now, I realize that doesn't mean anything. But I also don't know anybody who's experienced symptoms or adverse effects from a jab. Now, I'm told that there are tens of thousands who are going through adverse effects. Now, because I haven't seen it doesn't mean it's not true. That would be an idiotic thing to say. I haven't seen our doctor, that doesn't mean it's not there. But when I'm being, and this is where I get this, we're told this is the thing, and then, oh, wait, stop, hang on, this is a new thing. So the government and the media are telling us what we need to be thinking. But I go outside and look around, and even now I see a rare person here and there wearing a mask. But what I'm finding is that the people I run into who are willing to engage in conversation, they're just good people. And I don't care when I say hi to them and they say hi back and we're talking about the kids' basketball game at the YMCA or whatever it is we find to chat about. We have plenty of things to chat about that are just normal conversations that don't have anything to do with ideology or philosophy or patriotism or politics of any kind. And if you experience that, pay attention to that, say, you know, this is very refreshing. This is, I get the black and the red and the blue and all that, the pills screwed up. I think that's white pill stuff. I think that's optimism, where people are just being good people, speaking civilly and kindly about just inane stuff. And that's fine. You know, we need the inane stuff. Not everything has to be this problem-solving conversation about what do we need to do. Well, we probably need to do nothing. We just need to have a good time, speak civilly to each other, leave feeling better than we got here. That's a really valuable thing to have happen in your community, because you're sending somebody home in a good spirit and they're going to go share that good spirit with the family. So the seeing that there's this difference in what you're told is going on, because I don't see it. Again, I know that doesn't mean it's not there. But the people that I run into are not the government, and they certainly aren't the country. They're just folks. And I think that that's a way to make that distinction, that government is some people that I see them on Twitter. In fact, one of them's coming to my county in a couple of days to hear the concerns of his people. So I'm toying with the idea of actually going to this thing, but I probably shouldn't, because it'll just make me mad. So I think it's a fairly new understanding that the government and the people are not the same.
Well, Dan, a question. When did you first ever hear the term psychological operation or PSYOP or mind control? When did that first become a thing in your thought process?
I think the introduction to the phrase was probably some psych class in junior college when they talked about Milgram's experiments and mind control. And so it was presented as a thing that was possible. There are probably people who are pointing at the radio screaming, that wasn't true or something. So I think there's some debunking about the Milgram thing, but that's not the point. That there was these things going on. When a lot of this stuff sort of came to my knowledge, Operation Mockingbird and Paperclip and MKUltra and a bunch of these other things has been within the last 5 years. And that was following libertarian thinkers, or at least not mainstream R&D thinkers. And once you get out of the mainstream media funnel of information and recognize that there's a lot of other funnels of information, and just because the mainstream media says they're wacky doesn't mean that they are. I mean, they have a reason to say they're wacky. They don't want you to listen to that. But there's a lot of information out there from people who have been discredited by the government and the mainstream media, and one of them just died. Uncle Ted just died. And he was one of the first ones. But all that we know is that he did a bad thing and he killed people. Well, yes, I think everybody can agree that blowing somebody up with a bomb in the mail, that's a bad thing to do. That was not a good choice. I don't know enough about why he chose that as the vehicle he needed to, but the stuff he wrote before that, he sort of anticipated 30 years or whatever ahead of time exactly what we're going on now. So he's been discredited because he murdered some people. Well, that's a horrible thing to do, but that doesn't invalidate the rest of the information he had. So that stuff is there. You have to do some digital legwork to find it, and it's becoming even more difficult to find because they who I'm going to steal a John Jay line, people who run the world control it. So there's things they don't want you to find.
Wow, very interesting. Well, let me ask you this question. What was there an aha moment, or was it gradual when you realized that the libertarian approach wasn't what you thought it was?
That's a good question. And it built up a little bit at a time. And part of the refreshing part of it, which I've already mentioned, was that it was unconventional thinking. And one of the things that I still think is to the libertarian credit is, for the most part, I think libertarians are avid readers and seekers of information. I don't think that that's necessarily true for the body of D and the body of R as a whole. Certainly there are some in those camps who are avid readers and seekers of information. It just seems to me that the majority of libertarians do read a lot about politics and economics and foreign policy. And so they have a better handle on consequences and unintended consequences and what the whole fiat currency, treasury, Fed Reserve, they get a good handle on that. They understand that, which is sort of key to understanding basic economics and how government works. Where it stopped being interesting was when I recognized, and I had the help of some old fart in Georgia with us, recognizing that even libertarians want to keep you in a box. And the box is we have to follow the Constitution. Well, if everybody's following the Constitution, then everybody's doing the same wrong thing. You just have three different versions of doing the same wrong thing. So now, there's a discord that happens. And then once you see the discord, it sort of spreads to everything. If you have to be confined by something written 238-ish years ago, and you call yourself not the mainstream party, but you still insist on using the handcuffs from before, fundamentally, are you really any different? And that's where that sort of happened almost immediately. That was like a holy moly, that's a big thing to think about. And that really changed a lot. So That's a fairly recent thing, and that was pretty quick.
Well, that's Dan, I'm really impressed with that. That's but I have no idea who that old fart in Georgia was. But
I never met him.
Okay, good. But as you are aware, I wrote articles for one of the top libertarian websites in this country for about 5 years. So I had and I too was led to the libertarian viewpoint by the economist of the time, especially at the time Thomas DiLorenzo, because of his work on Abraham Lincoln and Alexander Hamilton, who, being a Southerner by birth and a Southerner who is very, very proud of his heritage and his ancestors. I was really impressed with DiLorenzo's work, and he was revealing historical facts as an economist that others weren't. And I also was really fond of Butler Schaefer, God rest his soul, may rest in peace, who was an absolute, and I actually talked with him on multiple occasions on the phone, and he gave me some real insight. Well, I guess the aha moment for me was when I was writing articles for this libertarian website, and suddenly I saw some of my articles rejected. No, I can't print this. Well, my question was, why? You know, why would a libertarian want to censor what someone thought or what someone wrote? It didn't make sense to me. Well, and then I saw where I would print, where I would submit certain articles, and certain parts of those articles were removed without my permission. Well, that troubled me. And then I finally, you know, I think it was 2010, I wrote an article that was titled Comfortable Patriotism. And I was told, no, we can't print that because that article is a clarion call for civil disobedience. And my comment to the gentleman whose name's on the website was, civil disobedience is what America is all about. Because had it not been for civil disobedience with the Boston Tea Party, with the Concord and, you know, Lexington, had it not been for civil disobedience, this country wouldn't exist. Well, okay, that's all right. No, we're not going to publish that article. It's a clarion call for civil disobedience. Well, and the article wasn't published, but 3 days later, I've got two black SUVs sitting in my yard with FBI agents who have a copy of my article that wasn't published. And I realized, you know, I had affiliations with the National Security Agency, and I know that every clack on your keyboard is monitored, and I know every telephone conversation is monitored and all this other stuff, internet, I know that. So, but I was wondering when the FBI agents asked me, why are you anti-government? And my response was, I am not anti-government. I am anti-corrupt government. Well, my viewpoint has now changed. I am totally anti-government. But that was the point at the time. And from that point on, when that article was rejected, you know, comfortable patriotism, when that article was rejected, I submitted no more articles to that libertarian website. But then I began to embark on my own quest, and I had tons of source document that I had obtained from the National, you know, from the National Archives, from the Library of Congress, University of Virginia, Rotunda Collection, University of North Carolina, University of South Carolina. I was a collecting documents freak. And I just loved to collect these documents, and many of them until about 2009, I hadn't read 2010. And then I really got into them. I was really intrigued by those. And then I began to realize, and especially in 2010, when in a interview, and of course it's been removed from the YouTube, but Dr. Ron Paul made the statement, and I had interviewed Dr. Paul on two separate occasions when I was writing for Sierra Times. And I was very much impressed with Dr. Paul. And but in 2010, when he said there, as a Republican, there is only so much liberty you can get away with. That statement really troubled me, Dan. only so much liberty we can get away with. The actual thought of that is that liberty is not guaranteed. We have to steal it. And that really troubled me. What are your thoughts on that?
You told me about that conversation, and I don't know what to make of that. It seems discordant with the figure we hear about as Ron Paul, the libertarian. Maybe I'm not going to apologize for him, but it sounds like a politician's answer instead of a heartfelt pro-liberty, rightful liberty answer. And I don't know the circumstances, but again, he said what he said. It sounds pessimistic.
Well, the thing that troubled me, and I'll give you a little bit of the parameters of that, there was a Ron Paul acolyte who was running for Congress in Texas, where Ron Paul was a congressman. And this person who had adopted all of the Ron Paul program, he was running for office against an in-place neocon Republican. Ron Paul did not support the guy who was his, you know, who had adopted his philosophy, but Ron Paul supported the in-place neocon. And that's when he was questioned about that, is when he said, there's only so much liberty you can get away with in the Republican Party. And that to me was such a contrast, I could no longer participate. I could no longer be a libertarian because this made no sense to me. And I have to be open too in the fact that in 2005, I was very active. I was one of the leaders on the ground of the Minuteman Project in Arizona in April of 2005. And I was writing at that time for this libertarian website. And they would not publish anything that I had to say in most instances about what was happening on the border, because they said, we as libertarians, we support open borders. And I did an article and I said, okay, I quoted Hans Hermann Hoppe, who was a libertarian who had written a book and several articles. And he had written an article about, is it immigration or is it invasion? And I quoted heavily from him, and I submitted that article back in 2005, and the Libertarian site wouldn't publish it because they said, we are an open borders party. Well, open borders is suicide when the people who are crossing that border are coming here to kill you, which made no sense to me, but still my article would not be published. And that is, and that, and things being changed in my articles, and then the FBI coming to visit me about an article I had submitted, led me to believe that libertarians were just, as I've used this phrase before and you found it humorous, libertarians are just Republicans in sandals. So
it's still funny.
So looking at that experience, and you and I have shared that before, what are your thoughts?
Well, they are just that. They are thoughts. I have no support of any kind just from my thinking, but it seems that there's, to steal an economics phrase, as an invisible hand managing at least some part of that website. And there's no way for me to know whether that's true or not, but if there is something that is determined to be off limits, my question is going to be, who's making that determination? So it sounds like somebody higher. And what we've discovered in the last few years is there's always somebody higher. There's someone managing the strings.
The unseen hand?
The unseen hand.
Well, I thought it was really remarkable in so many instances is that recently the owner of that libertarian website actually quoted in one of his articles something I had said 10 years ago. And I actually sent him an email thanking him for quoting something I had written all those years ago, and he didn't even bother to respond. I found that, I wasn't surprised, but I found it very telling.
It is curious.
Well, absolutely, and I totally agree with that. When we come back on the flip side of this hour and we start the second hour, I'm going to hit you with the hard one, and that is, what was the stimulus that led you from being an L to an A?
Mm-hmm.
What brought you from being a libertarian to being an anarchist? And for those of us who have made that transition, it's certainly going to be interesting to hear your side. But we also know, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this program, we also know that we have a lot of people out there who are still involved in this transition.
Right.
Well, here comes the music, buddy. We'll see you on the flip side.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll add the links to Mike's appearances on this show to the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/237. As you heard teased, hour two is a bit more of current affairs for me, anyway. That second hour will be episode 238. Thank you for listening. I appreciate you being here. Thanks also to my Patreon supporters. There isn't a chef's table for this episode, but there is a good supply of chef's tables on the Patreon page. The link to become a patron is on the show notes page. Also on the show notes page is a link to Cooking for Comfort, my cookbook, for all things, nearly all things, one-pot meals. They're easy meals to make, and you can do it, and it's a fun way to feed your family without all that cleanup. Some cleanup, but not too much. Gotta clean stuff. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.